morning. It's 9 o'clock. I'll call the meeting to order for Wednesday, July 20th. We have Daniel, Kirby, and myself chairing. Jenny is on approved work travel, and Maria is on approved vacation. All right, we're looking for a motion to adopt the agenda as is.
So moved.
Support.
Motion by Daniel, seconded by Kirby. Questions or comments? I see none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstention? Motion carries. Looking for a motion to approve the July 6, 2022 LOC meeting minutes and forward to the Business Committee for consideration.
So moved.
Motion made by Daniel.
Support.
Seconded by Kirby. Questions or comments? If none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstention? Motion carries. Current business, Children's Code amendments. Clarissa.
This item starts on page 4 of your packet. So the request for amendments to the Children's Code first came to the LOC from the Indian Child Welfare Department on August 25th, 2020 for the purpose of addressing customary adoption. So the LOC added the Children's Code to its active files list on October 7th, 2020. So since then, the LOC has held 9 work meetings and collaborated with the nation's Indian Child Welfare Department, Oneida Law Office, and the Oneida Family Court on the development of amendments to the Children's Code. So the Children's Code provides for the welfare, care, and protection of Oneida children through the preservation of the family unit, while recognizing that in some circumstances, it may be in the child's best interest to not be reunited with his or her family. Furthermore, the law strengthens family life by assisting parents in fulfilling their responsibilities, as well as facilitating the return of Oneida children to the jurisdiction of the nation, acknowledging the customs and traditions of the nation when raising an Oneida child. So it's the policy of the nation to ensure that there's a standard process for conducting judicial proceedings and other procedures in which children and all other interested parties are provided fair hearings, in addition to ensuring their legal rights are recognized and enforced while protecting the public safety. So the proposed amendments to the Children's Code will provide that any orders made by the court under this law or any orders made by a court of competent jurisdiction regarding child welfare matters shall supersede any other order made by this court or a court of competent jurisdiction regarding custody or placement of a child until the Children's Code or other child welfare orders are dismissed. It provides that the department may enter into a protective plan with the family. It updates the general notice provisions in the Children's Code, as well as the notice provisions throughout the Children's Code, to provide greater clarification on providing notice in child welfare matters. It allows the department to withhold the placement provider's identifying information from the child's parent, guardian, or legal custodian if there are reasonable grounds to believe that disclosure would result in imminent danger to the child or anyone else, but that a parent, guardian, or legal custodian may request judicial review of the decision to withhold that identifying information. It provides clarification on how a matter is referred to the United Nations Child Support Agency for initiating a paternity action, and it allows the department to sign documents required by the Child Support Agency on behalf of the family for the limited purpose of initiating a paternity action. It allows the department to make an ex parte request to the court to conduct an in-camera review to determine what information should and should not be released to parties in their counsel. It allows a child to be held in custody in a hospital or other medical or mental health facility. It provides information that may be, but not required to be, included in the court's order to hold a child in custody. It allows the department to request the placement of the child outside of the child's home at the plea hearing. It allows for the suspension of parental rights in addition to the termination of parental rights. It provides information that may be but is not required to be included in the court's order of disposition for the suspension or termination of parental rights. It clarifies that adoption under this law shall take the form of customary adoption when the court has granted a petition to suspend parental rights, and take the form of a closed adoption when the court has granted a petition to terminate parental rights. And then it allows the department to contract with a third-party agency to conduct an adoption investigation that was ordered by the court, and it makes other minor drafting revisions throughout the law. So on April 20th, 2022, the LOC approved the draft of the Children's Code amendments and directed that a legislative analysis be developed. Then on May 4th, 2022, the LOC approved an updated draft in the legislative analysis. On May 18th, the LOC approved the public meeting packet and forwarded the Children's Code amendments to a public meeting to be held on June 15th, 2022. So the public meeting was held on June 15th, 2022, right here in the Norwood Hill Center's Business Committee Conference Room and also on Microsoft Teams. So no one provided comment during the public meeting. The public comment period was then held open until June 22nd, and we received one submission of written comments during that public comment period. So on July 6th, the LOC accepted the public comments and the public comment review memo and deferred these items to a work meeting for further consideration. So later that same day, the LOC held a work meeting to review and consider the comments received. So on page 7 of your packet, you'll see the public comment review memorandum. So this document served as a tool for the LOC when they reviewed and considered the public comments that were received as required by the Legislative Procedures Act. So if you look at that memo, it's organized by topic. So immediately after the comment divider in bold, you'll see any relevant excerpt from the law. This is followed by the verbatim comment received, including the specifics of who made the comment and whether it's oral or written. Next is the response section, which is my attorney response to the LOC. So here's where I provide the LOC any relevant background information on the motivation or purpose of the law, any in-depth explanation of the provision of the law, and potential options for how to consider the comment. And then the last section under every comment is the LOC consideration. So this will show you the LOC's discussion and decision on how to address each comment. So the LOC did make a revision to the law based on the public comments that were received. So on page 11 of your packet, you'll see a redline draft of the proposed amendments to the Children's Code, which demonstrates the change to the law that was made after the public meeting. Then on page 22 of the packet, starting on line 504 of the draft, section 708.14-2, in the discovery and record section of the law, a new provision was added, which provides that the department shall make available for inspection or disclosure the contents of any record kept, regardless of the originating source, to a guardian ad litem appointed in a children's code or family law case when that access is granted by order of the court. So then on page 57 of your packet, you'll find a redline draft that includes all of the proposed amendments to the children's code from the currently effective draft. And this is followed by a clean draft on page 104 and an updated legislative analysis on page 150. So the first motion that we're asking the LOC to consider in regard to the Children's Code amendments is to consider a motion to approve the updated public comment review memorandum draft and legislative analysis.
I'll make a motion.
Motion made by Daniel. Seconded by Kirby. Questions or comments? Just hit the button in the middle and then identify yourself and then go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Lydia Witte. I'm the staff attorney. I'm here on behalf of the Indian Child Welfare Department. I'm here to make a brief comment about the added language under the discovery and records portion that was added after the written comment regarding information to be released to guardians ad litems. So the 708.14-2, the new language was the department shall make available for inspection or disclosure the contents of any record kept, regardless of the originating source, to a guardian ad litem appointed in a children's code or family law case when that access is granted by order of the court. So the department agrees that we do want there to be easy flow of information between the department and the guardian ad litems. And we agree with that written comment that we want there to be good information kept. We don't want to hold up the job of the guardian ad litem. We agree that it's important work that they're doing. We have some concerns when it comes to the originating source of the information. For example, the department is provided information from enrollments, that we have an MOU with the enrollments department. And in that MOU, anything that we get from enrollments, we are not to release at all. That includes certified letters of enrollment and family trees. So that was just one concern that we had about if we are now ordered to release information that we get from other entities or agencies, would that now hinder us possibly from continuing to get that information? And then the other concern when it came to releasing information to guardian ad litem that are appointed in family law cases having to do with like divorce, legal custody modifications, or physical placement modifications of children. An example would be the department has noticed that during these contentious litigations of physical placement issues in family court, the department sometimes gets false reports of child abuse or neglect, and now we would have to potentially release all those unsubstantiated false reports to a guardian ad litem that would then have to weed through all that information to determine, you know, during their investigation. So the concern is releasing everything we have during a family court case.
So what would your recommendation be moving forward if we would like to still have the guardian ad litem have that information? I mean, how do you want to move forward with this?
Because well, my recommendation would be to strike the family law case language from 708.14-2. And then we are not opposed to allowing a guardian ad litem. The language does say to inspect. So allowing the guardian ad litem to come to the department and inspect that information, but that the department does not provide physical copies of these things.
Hello, see input.
I had a couple questions. With the family law case, wouldn't there be scenarios where a guardian ad litem would need that information?
I did ask the department if we have ever had an instance where a family court guardian ad litem submitted a request, and they said that that has happened, and in the situation that it did happen, it was a county case that had the child in need of protection and services case, and the department was involved as an Indian Child Welfare Act case. So what the department did was advise the guardian ad litem to contact the county and get records from the county. That's the one example that I have of a family court guardian ad litem contact. So perhaps it doesn't occur that often, but we do just have concerns about what could be opened in the future.
Right. I think I understand that, but I'm wondering if there is a way to, I guess, a different process, whether that we could be in the law or through policy that could be created. So in case the scenario arises that they could get access if needed, I don't know if the department has a solution for that.
I think the issue that was identified in the public comment that we received is the comment came from a guardian ad litem who said that they've come into the issue where they weren't able to get access information in an efficient manner because they were required to get the authorization form signed from the parent. And it was the court's recommendation that this language be included because there's already language in the court order that states the guardian ad litem should have access to this information. So the court's opinion was that the court order should be sufficient enough for them to get access without authorization forms. But given that if this issue is arising, then that's why they recommended that this language be added to the law to be clarified. So there's already the language in the order that kind of addresses this issue. And I don't know what page that's on.
I've never worked with
it. While we're waiting for that, what does the state do in a regular case now with the guardian ad litem? Are they able to get the access to all the information in a state case?
When it comes to a CHIPS case, they are allowed to, I believe that they do gain access to records that the county has, and then they are allowed. Another example is a recorded video interview of a child that was performed at the Child Advocacy Center. the guardian ad litem is allowed to go to the corp counsel office and view the video. They're not handed a digital copy of the video.
Okay. Crystal?
My thought was, what if you struck a balance with changing the language to exactly the request of the court in stating that where a court order requires release of information to a guardian ad litem, no additional parental consent is required, and that information not subject to release will be available for inspection, so that you're getting right to the heart of the issue and identifying that no parental authorizations are needed, and you're also safeguarding information that can't be physically released and available only for inspection, similar to provisions in the audit law, where you can't get a copy of an audit, you can come and look at it.
Kirby?
Yeah. And I'd like to just mention that in this added 708.14-2, it already states in the last sentence, family law case, when that access is granted by order of the court. So it states that in here already. And I guess my concern with the request is, when there's a guardian ad litem appointed to a child, don't they become part of that team of attorneys and courts for the protection of that child? And aren't they held to the same standards of confidentiality as everybody else in that courtroom or in that system? And so I don't see any reason to change the language, because they are held to the same confidentiality standards of the others involved in cases.
Crystal?
That's actually not true, because most attorneys in the state, or most all guardian ad litems in the state system are required to be licensed attorneys, and that's not true in the Oneida Family Court. So while there are standards in our law for becoming a guardian ad litem and for revoking those privileges, it's not the same standards that you find within the state, where someone acting outside the realm of their scope would also lose their professional license.
I think Kirby's point was getting at that in regard to the family court case, the guardian ad litem plays a role with kind of coming to that decision together with the recommendations of the ICW department, the recommendations of the guardian ad litem. I think that's what Kirby was kind of getting
at. Yeah, because I would think too, if a guardian ad litem is releasing confidentiality, they would lose their ability to be a guardian ad litem, just like an attorney could lose their license for being an attorney for doing something wrong. So I think it would work on both cases. They would lose attorney, it would be a higher license, but an ad litem could use the ability to be a guardian ad litem.
I agree with that, but I think the example that Lydia provided is a really strong example from trust and enrollments. I actually am the one who drafted those memorandums of agreement that allows access to their database in limited circumstances when I was representing the Trust and Enrollment Committee. And they take the information they provide very, very seriously. So I would say that if this is going to stay in the law, that the memorandum of agreement would require amendment, and you would want to make sure that that's not going to impede their access to information, and that Trust and Enrollments will still be willing to provide those certifications and family trees, knowing that they would be physically released outside of the Indian Child Welfare Department.
Leah?
I also wanted to just clarify, I do agree with you that a guardian ad litem should be kept to the highest standard of confidentiality as part of their ethical duty of the work that they're doing for the court and for the child. When it comes to family law cases, the Indian Child Welfare Department isn't part of the team when it comes to determining things like physical placement and legal custody as filed underneath a family court motion or a divorce action or a paternity action.
Clarissa?
So right now the language says that the department shall make available for inspection or disclosure the contents of any record kept regardless of the originating source to a guardian ad litem appointed in a children's code or family law case when that access is granted by order of the court. Wouldn't a simple solution, if the concern is the trust enrollment records, to ask the court to kind of make that exception in their order to say that this doesn't include that information, because I think information like an enrollment certification or a family tree might not necessarily be the information that the guardian ad litem is getting at in these situations anyways.
I like that fix.
But you would need to almost put that in the law, because now you're relying on the judiciary to incorporate that into their orders. Maybe a fix could be to put excluding information otherwise bound to confidentiality or something like that in the law.
My only concern about that would be that sounds kind of vague, and then we don't know.
It's got to be more specific.
But if it's not broad enough to cover other instances, then you're only going to cover the trust and enrollments issue. Like Lydia pointed out, in the family court, the Indian Child Welfare area isn't a party to the case. So it would be inappropriate, actually, for a judge to write an order requiring disclosure of information from a non-party, unless they were subpoenaed. So they're not a party to the litigation. That's between mother and father and their attorneys and the guardian ad litem, who is the attorney for the child. Indian Child Welfare is not involved in that at all. So if they receive unsupported complaints that have not been substantiated by law enforcement or their office, it would not be appropriate to share that in this realm of mother, father, and guardian ad litem.
I mean, I think that point's moot, because the court's already saying that they ordered that information to be shared with the guardian ad litem.
Just, that's not moot, because this legislature is able to determine whether or not that's appropriate. And just because our family court is ordering things doesn't mean that that's always appropriate. We have seen our family court take missteps in some other instances, and the law is intended to provide the boundary of those actions. So this legislature can provide that boundary in stating that Indian Child Welfare is a non-party to a family court action, and it would not be appropriate for a judge through an order to require them to disclose things. You get things from non-parties through subpoenas. You don't get them through an order of the court.
Yes, but the LOC did already review and consider this comment and come to this decision. So
I understand
that,
but ICWA wasn't involved, is what she's saying, is that you guys made this decision and never brought them back in the loop on the change, and that's why she's here today to talk about it.
So is it possible to have trust enrollments amend the MOU?
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be the better fix then. Because
I think you should just pause this, though, until you know that they're in agreement to amend it, though, if that's the route you want to take. And I do think Lydia's statements regarding the family court disclosures are very valid.
Daniel?
I had a question regarding the MOU, and I'm wondering if, is that restriction in any other law, or is that just a policy in trust and enrollments not to disclose that information?
I don't know that it would be included in any other law. I'm trying to think of where trusted enrollments gets their authorizations from. It was in the per capita law, and I don't know what the status of that is anymore. But that is what put them in charge of safeguarding the enrollments. Maybe it's the membership ordinance. In one of the laws, trusted enrollments is delegated the authority to manage the membership rolls, and that is the authority that they rely on in granting these MOUs, to say you only get this when we approve it.
So I'm not a big fan of delaying our legislation, because we already went through a lot of the process already. So we need to come up with a better fix for today than if we're going to move this forward. If it's to take that part out.
Is the simplest solution to modify the MOU? Is that the simplest solution, or? Because I don't know if changing or eliminating that out of here makes it any clearer or provides a solution in the law.
The only thing I can think of that would allow you to move forward today and take those concerns into consideration would be something to the effect of excluding information subject to non-disclosure pursuant to another agreement. meaning that the court can't force you to breach an agreement with another party through their order. And that is a little bit more concise. It's not broad confidentiality under the public records law. It's specific to an agreement that is requiring that confidentiality.
I think that's what, if I'm understanding it, that's what I was thinking, that the court would specify specific information that would, that the guardian ad litem would need, not all information.
And what I'm saying is that the law should include the backstops that prohibits them from forcing the Indian Child Welfare Department to breach an agreement they have with another party in order to comply with the order, because that puts them in a terrible position. They either have to breach the MOU or follow the court order.
Is that doable, Clarissa?
I would need to think about it. I mean, my concern is I feel like that language is still broad if the only issue is the trust enrollment MOU. I still think the simplest is just to make sure that the court orders are specific as to the type of information that needs to be granted. Where's my, so what is the language? I have the language from the actual court order. So the language that the court provided that they include states, the guardian ad litem shall be provided access to all records in possession of juvenile intake, the tribal, county, or state department of social services, child welfare agencies, schools, or law enforcement agencies pertaining to the above captioned case, regardless of the originating source, including but not limited to medical, mental health, psychological, counseling, drug or alcohol records from a non-federally assisted program as defined in 42 CRF Part 2, financial, educational, employment, probation, and law enforcement records. So this language is already included in the court orders.
Again, that doesn't mean that it's appropriate. Because the court has included it in a court order does not always mean that it's appropriate. This law is intended to be the backstop of where legal action may and may not occur. So even if you wanted to limit it just to trust and enrollments and say that trust and enrollments information may not be shared but may is available for inspection, I think you're still getting closer. But I still think that you can't discredit that family law should be stricken. That guardian ad litem should not be entitled to information from a non-party in a case without a subpoena.
Kirby.
I'm just looking at the commenters, the person that submitted this and some of their rationale. And on their written recommendation, And reading through this, I'm understanding where they're at as a guardian ad litem. They just want it to be smoother. They're part of the team. They want access to some information they may need. And I do hear you that sometimes a judge makes an order that may not be appropriate. However, when a judge orders something in a courtroom, it is to be honored, whether you agree or disagree with it. And I think it could be left in there, and I'm hearing what they're saying. They're not always gonna need it, but in some cases they may. And even though there's a MOU between this agency and that agency, when a judge says, I order that information be disclosed to the guardian ad litem, that's the order. Whether there's an MOU or not, that's all one case, they're all on the same team. They're all in the courtroom for that child.
Yes, it's true that when a court orders something, that is the order, but there's also an appellate level, and when you're talking about this, then Indian Child Welfare Department may choose to appeal these orders, and that's only going to extend out these cases right further. So if you put the backstop in now so that they're able to comply with the order, you're not risking delay of family law cases because they don't agree with what was written into the law and they feel a need to protect that information.
Are the family court judges here aware of the MOU?
Rob Collins should be because he worked with some of them with me when he was in the law office, but I don't know that he would be remembering the specifics of them or if the other judge, I would imagine, wouldn't have knowledge of those. I just don't think that it's appropriate to say that we're going to rely on the judges to do the right thing, because then why can't we just rely on the attorneys to do the right thing? I mean, why do they get more credit and protection under the law than the agency who's working to protect this information? The law is intended to be the backstop. They're not even here today, so how can we rely on them to be the solution without them sitting down and saying, yes, we will comply to that, with that?
I don't think it's fair to necessarily say, oh, because they're not here, we can't rely on them today. The court did provide the feedback in regard to the comment and what information's already provided in the order. Again, like I said, the LLC has already considered this as a group and kind of made that decision.
But that's the problem, is that the court had the opportunity to provide feedback before today, and ICWA was never provided that opportunity. So while the group had a conversation and made a decision, they made that decision without access to all of the information, because not all of the appropriate parties were included in that discussion.
Well, LLC, it's up to you to make the decision. Daniel?
I think we need to get some clarification with the court. Maybe, I don't want to hold this up, but I think we need to make it very clear and for the future, not to me, even a current opinion of a current sitting judge might be okay. They might have an understanding, even if they were here, a part of this discussion in the room right now. Next year could be a different judge without that understanding. So I think we need to maybe have another work session to provide some more clarity, whether that's in the law or whether that's in the MOU. I don't know which or both needs a change, but I think should be changed before there's any further confusion, particularly, you know, in an actual court setting and a case. So
Kirby?
I don't want to delay the case moving forward, but I do see that we have some time, because the fiscal impact needs to be done yet, and that has to go to the finance, and we're going to be asking that to come back by August 17th. So we have a few weeks in there to address this, whether it's a work session, but I'd like to get some clarification. And I think if we delay this till the next LOC meeting for approval, we would still have time to get it approved, because we're also waiting for the fiscal impact study before it goes to the business committee, right?
Well, if you want the fiscal impact to go out today, you have to approve the draft to be sent forward. We can make the motion to approve this draft to be sent forward to a fiscal, and then add this to our next LOC work session to see if there's any last minute change in regard to that section you'd like to make.
That would be my motion.
I would recommend that you also include in your motion direction to the Indian Child Welfare Department to pursue an amendment to their memorandum of agreement, so that you have some resolution on that issue before your next meeting. And perhaps you don't need an amendment because you're able to resolve that issue, and then you would only be looking at the play between the family court and the guardian ad litem.
Daniel.
Kirby, would you want to add that to your motion?
I didn't recognize the motion yet.
Oh, okay. So, Clarissa, the statement you made that approving the...
So it would just be the motion to approve the updated public comment review memorandum, draft, and legislative analysis.
Right. And then
To add what she wanted to the memorandum?
Direct the Indian Child Welfare to amend the MOU with...
Pursue amendments. They can't unilaterally do it, but they can ask trust and enrollments to do that.
Direct Indian Child Welfare to pursue an amendment to the MOU with
Trust Enrollments.
So can add that to that.
Okay, first we have to withdraw Daniel's motion. that he had before. You had one before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to approve the updated public comment. So oh, yeah. We'll withdraw that.
Oh, yeah.
And I seconded it, and I support so withdrawing.
Daniel withdraws the motion.
And the second and agrees.
And seconder agrees. Okay, now we can have a new motion on the floor, Kirby.
And Clarissa, I'm looking for you for the wording on that.
Quick question.
Go ahead.
I agree with the motion, but potential motion. But do we need to add in the motion to, for the work meeting, to have NICWA department, court, and trust and enrollments in that work meeting? Do we need to put that in the motion?
We don't need it in a motion. I'll just add them to the work meeting.
Okay.
So could you want to restate the motion?
Yep. So approve the updated public comment review memorandum draft and legislative analysis and direct the Indian Child Welfare Department to pursue amendments to their MOU with the Trust Enrollment Department or committee, whichever one.
And you identify the work meeting?
We don't need to do that okay. In the motion.
Should there be clarification that this isn't approved for adoption and that it is only approved for the purpose of the fiscal?
I don't think we need that because on the chance that they decide there's no changes, if there's a non-legislative fix, then we're still ready to move forward.
Well, then can the motion incorporate that the LOC is committing to having a work meeting before forwarding for adoption?
We can do that.
Thank you.
So moved?
Yes.
Kirby makes the motion.
Second.
Seconded by Daniel. Questions or comments? See none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, abstention, motion carries. All right.
So on page 167 of your packet, you'll see the fiscal impact statement request memo. So the Legislative Procedures Act requires that a fiscal impact statement be provided for all proposed legislation of the nation. The fiscal impact statement is an estimate of the total fiscal year financial effects associated with the proposed legislation and should include startup costs, personnel, office costs, documentation costs, and an estimate of the amount of time necessary for an individual or agency to comply with the law after implementation. So the fiscal impact statement must be completed and submitted to the LOC prior to the proposed legislation being forwarded to the Oneida Business Committee for consideration. The fiscal impact statement provides the Oneida Business Committee information on what the potential adoption of the proposed legislation will cost the nation so that the Oneida Business Committee can determine if adoption of the proposed legislation is in the best interest of the nation. The Legislative Procedures Act grants the LOC the authority to direct the finance department or any agency who may administer a program if legislation is enacted or may have financial information concerning the subject matter of the legislation to submit a fiscal impact statement. So Oneida Business Committee Resolution BC 102828, titled Further Interpretation of Fiscal Impact Statement in the Legislative Procedures Act, provides further clarification on the process for directing a fiscal impact statement be completed. This resolution provides that upon final approval of draft legislation by the LOC, the LOC may direct the Finance Department to provide a neutral and unbiased fiscal impact statement to the LOC within 10 business days for inclusion in adoption materials. So now that the draft of the Children's Code Amendments was approved, the Fiscal Impact Statement Request Memorandum is a memo from the LOC to the Finance Department directing that a fiscal impact statement of the proposed amendments to this law be completed and provided to the LOC by August 17, 2022. So we're asking the LOC to consider adopting a motion to approve the Fiscal Impact Statement Request Memorandum and forward to the Finance Department directing that a fiscal impact statement be prepared and submitted to the LOC by August 17, 2022.
Yeah, I know we have a date on there, but I want to double check with our finances if that's going to be enough time.
Well, it's always a should be answer if I can answer you.
Go ahead.
We're in the middle of budget, of course, shorthanded. We'll do what we're asked. I don't sense there's a demonstrable amount of research, but we'll dive in and try and get it cranked up to honor the
right. Is that okay?
Yep, and for this one, I did provide an extended timeline, so it's more than the 10 days, just under knowing that they're in the middle of their budget season.
Thank you.
Daniel made the motion?
Daniel made the motion.
Support.
Seconded by Kirby. Questions or comments? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, abstention, motion carries.
United Nation Assistant Law Fund Law, Clarissa.
So this item starts on page 169 of your packet. The United Nation Assistance Fund Law was adopted by the Business Committee on an emergency basis on June 8, 2022, and it established the United Nation Assistance Fund to govern how the nation provides financial assistance to its members pursuant to the United General Welfare Law. It's the policy of the nation to prioritize the general welfare needs of its members and recognize that the interests of the nation are advanced when its members remain confident that their general welfare needs can be met. So the United Nation Assistance Fund Law will establish the United Nation Assistance Fund as an approved program of the nation in accordance with the United General Welfare Law, provide how this program qualifies for general welfare exclusion, provide the eligibility requirements for accessing assistance from the United Nation Assistance Fund, which is that a person is a member of the nation, age 18 or older, and submits a completed application during the designated submission timeframe. It provides the minimum requirements for the information that must be included on the application. It provides how and when funds from the United Nation Assistance Fund are disbursed. It provides for the type of expenses that shall be considered qualifying expenditures for use of assistance from the United Nation Assistance Fund by the recipient. It provides information on the funding source and who determines that amount of available funding to an eligible participant. And it provides that the Trust Enrollment Department is the department that has the responsibilities to administer the United Nation Assistance Fund. So the emergency adoption of the United Nation Assistance Fund Law will expire on December 8, 2022. The LOC is now seeking the permanent adoption of the United Nation Assistance Fund Law. So on page 171 of your packet, you'll see a draft of the proposed United Nation Assistance Fund Law, and this is followed by a legislative analysis on page 175 of your packet. So we're asking the LOC to consider adopting a motion to approve the draft and legislative analysis for the United Nation Assistance Fund Law.
Motion made by Daniel.
Support.
Seconded by Kirby. Questions or comments? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, abstention, motion carries. New submissions, probate law.
Clarissa. This item starts on page 179 of your packet. So on July 14, 2022, the Legislative Operating Committee received a request from Nicole Rommel with the Environmental Health Safety Land and Agriculture Division, more specifically Land Management, for the development of a probate law which would remove the probate provisions from the real property law and instead create a standalone law. So we are now asking the LOC to consider the adoption of a motion to add the probate law to the active files list with a designated sponsor.
I just want to clarify that Nicole didn't have it in her request, but I just want the LOC to be aware of the process that we're asking you to take on, in that we're asking you to work this through approval through you, but also through the federal government pursuant to the American Indian Probate Reform Act, similar to the leasing law. And then when it's through there, then when our individual trust land probates go to the BIA for administration, they would apply our law, not the federal law. It doesn't authorize us the same way as the leasing law does to administer them on our own behalf, but it requires the federal government to apply our processes and procedures instead of their own, which can, for example, it includes provisions that keep alienation outside of tribal members so that we retain full jurisdiction over Indian lands.
The only issue I have with that is that BIA slows everything down for us. And if it's gonna slow this down, I'm not gonna be in agreement with that.
Well, you could adopt it and make it applicable as to all of the sections that don't apply to federal probates and say that that section will be approved or will be effective only upon approval by the federal government. So it's in the law that we provided as a starting point. It is an entirely separate section. So, when you adopt it through the resolution, you could do it in that function.
Kirby?
Okay, at this stage of the game, though, it's just putting this to the active files list and finding the sponsor. So I make a motion to put it to the active files list that noted and working, moving forward. But sponsor, I'd sponsor it if no one else does.
Okay. Second, Crystal, just a quick question before I forget. It's probably more for a work session, but with federal lands, would that What you stated, would that change the scenario? Like, trust lands, it's United States land, so any properties on that land would it still have to go through federal BIA approvals and laws?
It's very specific. So if it's tribal trust land, that goes through our own process. For example, if somebody has a lease and it's on trust land, but it's our trust land, then that goes through our own probate process. If it's individual trust land, the federal government probates the land only, and then all of the improvements or anything else on, like if you had cars, a house, anything within the house, that's all local probate. Their probate applies only to the land. And that's for individual trust land. So this law would cover both tribal trust land and probates that are not held in trust, and have a section that covers probates of individual trust land by the federal government.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Kirby made the motion to add himself as a sponsor.
Second.
Seconded by Daniel. Questions or comments? I see none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, abstention, motion carries. Last item, administrative updates. Looking for a motion to enter the e-poll results of the July 7th, 2022 e-poll entitled Adoption of the Emergency Amendments to the Election Law.
So moved.
Motion second. By Kirby.
Second.
Seconded by Daniel. Questions or comments? I see none. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, abstention, motion carries. Looking for a motion to adjourn at 9:46.
Support.
Motion by Daniel, seconded by Kirby. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, abstention, motion carries. Thanks, everyone.
Dang it, right now I just found the section that I was looking for in the conversation.